Now to welcome onto the show Mike Streisguth. And I said your name correctly, Mike?
You did. Perfect.
Brilliant. Or Michael, actually, as it says on the book. Anyway, just to get that right for anybody looking at the book. It's called Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison and the American Music Series. And this is a hardcover available. Mike's been on the show before talking about Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson and the Outlaws back in 2014. How time flies. But he's back now with a book, Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison. Good afternoon to you, Mike. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Good to hear from you.
Good to have you on as well. And love talking country music with you, of course. And let's start off with whereabouts. We're talking 1963 when Johnny Cash went to Folsom Prison, and it led on to more appearances, didn't it? Of course, San Quentin coming up and so on. How big was this in Johnny Cash's career?
Well, this show in 1968, actually, which was recorded.
Oh, what did I say? I said 63. Sorry, yeah, I read it wrong.
it actually turned his career around.
Yeah,
I mean, so on a personal, professional level, it was big. Sure. I mean, he was coming off a few years of heavy drug abuse, missed shows. Lackluster performances in the studio and on stage, and I think the popularity of this album just pulled him into a different state of mind, into a different world commercially.
Yeah.
I mean, it went gold in the States within a few months, and the next thing you know, he's playing very large auditoriums and rock arenas. He's got an ABC television program. He's the subject of documentary filmmakers, just on and on. So it you really can't underestimate the influence on his career.
And you look also, of course, around in the late 50s, early 60s, Jerry Lee Lewis, Elvis, doing the rock and roll kind of thing, but very much a country vibe, massive at the time. Goes into this lull, a lot of it's to do with addictions and so on. And almost like Elvis, has his comeback in 68. And that really kind of, they both coincide together in that respect, don't they, on a similar journey. Elvis was doing the movies, of course,
yeah.
Far more. But
no, it's interesting to note that. You're exactly right.
Yeah, so Folsom Prison, this is him really coming back into his prime. And you do see, I think, I love the early Johnny Cash stuff, but I think when you hit 1968 and he's kind of come through the worst of it and he's into the late 60s, early 70s, you see Johnny in his prime at that point for me. And so how did it all come about, Folsom Prison? He's always had a heart for the outcast and for people maybe downtrodden, as we hear in his songs.
Well, it's a long story, of course. He recorded Folsom Prison Blues in 1955, which was really his first hit on Sun Records. And he started getting mail from inmates around the country, who many of whom assumed he had done hard time, that he'd actually shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. And he began playing prisons. His first was Huntsville State Prison in Texas. He went to San Quentin in California in the late 1950s. And he, in fact, the country music star, who would be a country music star, Merle Haggard, was in the audience at San Quentin.
Yeah.
But he played finally Folsom Prison in 1967, and I think he knew that the marriage of the song and the prison would just make for great entertainment and would probably be very interesting to listen to if it were recorded live. And he tried to make that point with his record label, Columbia, but it wasn't interested. And finally, in 1968, a new Nashville-based producer comes online. His name is Bob Johnston, who your listeners may know as a producer of Bob Dylan's work earlier in the 1960s. And it was Bob Johnston who gave the project the green light. And so the next thing you know, January of 1968, they are in Folsom, and Cash did two shows. Not many people know that. He did two shows at Folsom that day, and basically the album was culled from that first show, which he did at about 9:30 in the morning on the 13th of January.
And I don't know, maybe you can tell me otherwise, of anybody else who's kind of done anything similar to this, because and also to the album to become so popular, and of course the San Quentin album to become so popular later. And it just, for me, it seems very unusual, you know. And if you just talk about artists today doing something like this, it's unheard of.
Well, it is, and I think this gets back to something you talked about, which was Cash's compassion for the disenfranchised. I think he knew that people on the inside would appreciate his visits. It gave them an experience that was something like people on the outside experience.
Yeah.
So that really was the, I think, in the end, the root of his prison shows. And he did many, many prison shows. Now, it's interesting to note that earlier in the 1960s, none other than Sammy Davis Jr. had performed at Folsom Prison.
Wow.
the difference is that Sammy Davis Jr. didn't record his show. So Johnny Cash had the foresight to record it, and now we're talking about it all these years later.
And Mike, there's a real rawness that comes from it. You know, if you say, oh, you know, and I've got other Johnny Cash albums where he's live in Denmark or somewhere like that, and the great concerts. But when, you know, it's almost quite, I don't know what the word is, a sanitized way of recording an album, either in a studio or in a concert that's well rehearsed and well planned. Not saying these weren't rehearsed, of course, but it gave you the impression that anything could happen next. And Johnny's character made that happen as well. You just felt like, you know, one moment he's maybe having a go at the guards, and it just feels like anything could happen. It could tip in either direction. And it's just a nervousness about the whole thing as well.
I think you're right. I mean, the expectations here were very low. I mean, I spoke to Fluke Holland, who was Cash's drummer, and he said that he didn't think that they were going to sell enough records to pay for the tape that it was recorded onto. and so there was not much planning. There was some rehearsal the night before, but basically they were going into prison to do a Johnny Cash show. Now, he did tweak his set list to reflect the prison and the inmate experience, but I think there was nothing to lose, and I think that's why there's this sort of reckless abandon, and the crowd is going nuts, and Cash is feeding on this, and he would later say that he felt like in some situations in prisons that he had a certain power over the prisoners, that if he had said break, that they might have gone and done that. So there was, I think it was just the idea that this was unrehearsed. This was a man who was coming off a few bad years and perhaps suspected that this could be good for his career, but he let loose, and I think that's all there is to say about it. Now, if you compare Folsom to the album, the prison album that came out the following year, the San Quentin album, I think there's no comparison. The San Quentin album is quite rehearsed. He's quite self-conscious, I think.
Yeah.
There was a British documentary crew there making a film. So there's no comparison. It was really a moment that I think we're so fortunate to have. It was captured on tape.
And the nature of it was, of course, it had been done before by the time you get to San Quentin, and maybe even the prisoners were aware of it, of what had gone on before. But there's a few. I'm not sure if I'm getting my San Quentins and Folsoms getting mixed up here, so just forgive me. But there's one. I think it's on the San Quentin one actually where. And maybe this happened also in Folsom, where he was singing "I Walk the Line," and some of the prisoners shouted out something. It just seemed pretty negative. It was kind of, and he kind of just started humming a bit longer, just to say, "Look, I'm in charge of this show," you know. And he kind of pulls rank a little bit, and it just feels like he kind of wins them over during the show.
Yes, and that's San Quentin, and he didn't perform I Walk the Line at Folsom, and yeah, I mean, I think he was strutting more at San Quentin. I mean, I think he knew that in that short year things had changed, and the gift, I think, that was his show was probably aware. He was aware of that, I believe.
Like you say, I think he spent one night in prison that he jokes about pulling flowers or something like that, he says. But for some reason, because he sings about this, the prisoners know his songs, of course, and they relate to Johnny Cash, don't they?
Yes, and I think that's for a couple of reasons. One is that many of them did believe that he was a former inmate, and I was talking to a former prison guard, and the inmates would just offhandedly say to him, "Oh yeah, he was in prison. My uncle was in prison with him back in the late 1950s." and the prison guard would say, "Oh, is that right?" Of course, if Cash really were an ex-con, he probably wouldn't have been allowed into the prison to perform in the first place. But that was at play. But also, and this is from speaking to former inmates who were at Folsom in 1968, when Cash played there, they said that they really could feel his compassion. They really understood that Cash cared about them. And there's one man who appears in the book, actually. His name is Millard Dedman, and he was a jazz fan. Grew up in Oakland, not at all into country music, but he really connected to Cash because he felt like Cash was connecting with him, and he said all of a sudden he was cheering Cash. You know, go ahead, Johnny, give it to us. And I think that was important for me to know about, because critics and people associated with Cash himself talked about what a great thing that he had done for inmates that day. So for me, that was confirmed in talking to former inmates.
I don't think anybody would get away with this, but I think because of the stature of Johnny Cash, the kind of the aura that he carries and the deep voice, I think that really does resonate with a lot of people as well. And tell us, did you look into Glenn Shirley in there? Was that the original album, the same album where Greystone Chapel by Glenn Shirley, and Johnny Cash kind of sings that really for him there and then? It's quite a powerful moment.
That's right. Glenn Shirley was what they call a three-time loser, three convictions, and looking at a very long prison sentence at Folsom Prison. I mean, that's where you landed if you were a murderer, rapist, death row at Folsom. And as I said, Shirley is a three-time loser, and he wrote songs and played guitar inside, and the prison chaplain also happened to be Johnny Cash's minister in his hometown in California. And the minister got the song to Cash. Cash worked it up the night before and performed it. And I think, number one, it's great for the presentation. It's great for the show. Cash performing the song of an inmate. At the same time, the inmates... That they saved actually their most uproarious applause for that song, so it helped in that, you know, striking the balance. But over the years, Cash helped Glenn Shirley get out of prison, and on the promise that Shirley would go to work for him, and he did. He wrote for Cash's publishing company in Nashville. He went on the road with Cash and opened his shows. And for a while, things looked really good for Glenn Shirley. He embodied, in a way, Cash's aspiration for prisoners, that they could be indeed redeemed and live satisfying lives that would be inside the law. Unfortunately, in the end, Shirley couldn't cope with life on the outside. He'd been a big shot on the inside, and I think he had trouble coping with the regular world. Not to mention, he'd been thrust into this crazy Johnny Cash world, which would would have been tough for anybody to adapt to. And in 1978, he took his life in California.
It must have affected Johnny quite a lot, that. Well, it's a fascinating book, it really is, and it really does capture that moment in Johnny Cash's career. And, you know, there's the ups and downs in his career, and I know towards the late 70s, early 80s, he's a bit of a lull again, and then comes back. You can't keep a good man down, and even today, we're talking about it. Netflix got a series out with Johnny Cash at the White House. He's as popular as ever, isn't he, really?
It is, and I think it was that last gasp, if you will, toward the end of the last, you know, 6, 7, 8 years of his career, when he was with American Recordings, which the label, Rick Rubin, the producer, was very successful in bringing Cash back in front of a younger audience. And that was successful in large part because Rubin had dusted off the old dark image of Folsom Prison to present him again in the marketing of those albums toward the end of his career.
I don't know if you saw one of the interviews with Johnny Cash when he talks about he was in this club somewhere and he was doing some of the American Recording stuff. And somebody requested, or he decided to do one, some of his old stuff, and he said all these young people knew all the words to Ring of Fire, and I Walk the Line, and so it's kind of like, for him, it was a full circle, really, singing the old stuff again to young people, yet they still knew the old songs.
Yeah, I think it was satisfying for him. It really was, because he had gone through 10 years or so up to that point of commercial rejection. People thought he was dead. So that comeback, that second comeback, I think was tremendously satisfying. And many people around him say that it extended his life.
And the legend is probably bigger now than it ever was. In many ways, similar to Elvis in that respect. But yeah.
And I think in some ways it surpassed Elvis. I mean, this would be an interesting debate.
Yeah.
But this juggernaut just rolls on, the Johnny Cash juggernaut.
Yeah, absolutely great. Well, the book's available on our website, tre.radio. Mike, thanks for coming on. It's always enjoyable, and wish you all the very best with the book. I should imagine you having a bit of a rest, but any other projects on the go?
Well, I'm working on another book about country music, and this one is looking at the Southeast United States as a scene. You know, we talk about Nashville scene, the Austin scene, the L.A. scene in country music, but this is looking at another unique geographic area.
So are we talking, what area are we talking about here?
We're talking about North Carolina, the state of North Carolina. We're talking about the state of Virginia, Tennessee, West Virginia, Kentucky. And this is really a circuit in country music that would lead into Nashville in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And we have what I'm calling the second big bang in country music in the 80s, thanks in large part to this scene in the Southeast. And people like Ricky Skaggs and Marty Stewart are kind of leading the way and really then help invigorate country music in the 1980s.
Now, when you said Southeast, I thought you were going Florida, and I thought you were going to go Gulf Coast and Jimmy Buffett style there.
Not that far Southeast.
Have you done anything on Jimmy Buffett?
Have I ever done anything on Jimmy Buffett? No, I haven't. Yeah. I have not.
Absolutely. Well, I'd love to hear your views on some of that kind of side, that kind of country music. It's got a bit of reggae to it and a bit of Caribbean sound as well. But that's what country music is. It's a big, wide spectrum, isn't it? Thanks for coming.
Well, it is. Yeah. And many of the younger artists who are popular today have really connected with Jimmy Buffett's music and brought him in to the world, into their world, in many ways.
It's great what's happening, yeah. Zac Brown Band and all that as well. I could be talking to you all day, Mike, but we've unfortunately got to move on. But thanks for coming on.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
Cheers, Mike. Take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye.